Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is Hank Weaver welcoming you to another session of Hollywood Byline, Coast to Coast, and inviting you to listen in on an actual press conference with an outstanding Hollywood star.
Tonight, our guest is the distinguished star of motion pictures, Mr. David Niffen, soon to be seen in the Powell Pressburger production, The Elusive Pimpernel.
Mr. Niven will be interviewed by reporters whose beat is the film capital of the world, reporters who know Hollywood inside out. Let's meet them now as we take a turn around our Hollywood press table and pick up their bylines.
Lloyd Sloan, Hollywood Citizen News and Movie Life Magazine.
Mikhail Novak, Philadelphia Bulletin.
Dar Smith, the Los Angeles Daily News.
Sidney Skolsky, syndicated columnist, New York Post.
That's the imposing array of journalistic talent you will have to cope with in the next few minutes, Mr. David Niven. But first, let me explain that after their barrage of questions lets up, you'll have a chance to ask some questions of your own. But now, as a warm-up, Dar Smith has an anecdote on the subject of one David Niven. Dar?
At age 39...
Start over again. You can ad-lib through this.
Please do, yeah. At age 39, actor David Niven looks back over his life and to his horror finds that except for an 18-month period, he has spent it in school, in the Army, or under contract to producer Sam Goldwyn. These 18 months, were spent operating a questionable pony enterprise in New York, ducking out just in time to Bermuda, engaging in a three-day Cuban revolution, getting deported from Cuba, finding himself in San Francisco rather than Norway, where he intended to go, and finally being shanghaied aboard His Majesty's ship, Norfolk. This rather flighty and precarious existence ended up in an acting contract with Sam Goldwyn, under whose colors he served valiantly for 14 years. This contract ended last July, and both parties appeared to be relieved that it did. We hope today, somewhere in this melange, Niven will see fit to tell you how he happened to get aboard that ship, His Majesty's ship Norfolk, and if he does, you will see how this charming adventurer, this sort of a soldier of fortune, a guy equipped with dinner jacket and thirst, became one of the really fine actors in motion pictures.
Ha-ha. Mr. Niven.
Well, I'd come out of the thing like a sort of drunken half-wit. Thank you very much.
Well, I don't know when you stay, David.
Well, I get to answer all those questions at once. First of all, my pony enterprise is not questionable. It was a financial disaster, but it was never in question. And the other thing you accused me of was being deported. I left.
Well, hurriedly, though. Hurriedly, wasn't it?
With the utmost speed. With the hot breath of several men in blue right down the back of my neck.
But then we'll get to how you ever got off the SS Sam Goldwyn.
Well, that was a sort of armistice first, and then it all ended very peacefully and very happily,
And you lived ever after?
Now 4 months since, and New Year we exchanged greetings as from old generals and rival armies, and we're very happy and we love each other, and I cannot wait to work for him again.
Well, David, how about telling us about how you really got shanghaied aboard that battleship, the Norfolk?
Well, I was in Cuba, and that was the place, as a matter of fact, that I left rather hurriedly. The British consul advised that I should be a British subject. And there was, I made an elementary mistake. There was a revolution, well, a sort of shambles coming, and I made an elementary mistake, and I tried to get onto both sides at the same time. So the British consul recommended that I left, and I left, at the time I left quickly.
Well, I'll get you out of Cuba.
I got
to Cuba. I'll get you out of it right here.
Gentlemen, please.
Let him continue.
Oh, I thought he wanted.
No, there's a little bit more.
Okay.
Then I went down the canal, and I was going to catch a Japanese ship. It was going to Norway, which is the easiest way to get back to England. And it was called, I think, the Nanking Maru, or some kind of Maru, anyway. And I fell foul, happily, of the Marines off the American battleship, the Oklahoma. Anyway, they put me in something else Maru, and I went to San Francisco instead of going to Norway, and that's how I came to California. And do you want to know any more now?
Yes,
I'd like to ask a question, if I may. Were you or were you not put on, forcibly or otherwise, onto His Majesty's ship Bounty?
Yes, I was.
Oh, there's a lead up to that, I think.
Well, I have to get from San Francisco to the Bounty now.
And that's right.
Well, I only knew one person who lived in California at all, and she was a very nice girl called Lydia Macy. She's since happily married and lives in Italy now. And I called her up and I said, I'm here in San Francisco with my dinner jacket and $7. Can I come and stay for a few days? And she said, yes, come, quick, go along. So I said, where is it? She said, oh, it's just down the road. This place called Santa Barbara. Come straight down the road. Of course, it took me 5 days to get there. And fruit trucks and things. And I arrived. And my $7 was now about $2.50. I still had my dinner jacket and suitcase and everything. And I stayed there for 4 or 5 days. And one day, I looked out of the window, and there, bobbing about on the bay, was HMS Norfolk, which was a British cruiser who'd been in Bermuda when I was there about 6 months before. And I had been best man to the flag lieutenant when he was married, and I knew all the officers on board. So I got in a little boat, and I went out there, and they were there for 2 days, and they were going back. They'd been up to Canada, and they were going back to the canal, and going back to Bermuda. So they gave a farewell party, and I put my dinner jacket on, and I went to the party, and and the anchor came up at about 2 o'clock, and everybody had to leave, so everybody left, and I said, well, I better go now. And they said, oh, no, you stay with us. So I was... sounded rather attractive, thought, really. So I said, well, all right, where do I sleep? They said they gave me a place to sleep, and I tucked in. And I woke up in the morning feeling pretty dreadful, I must admit, in my dinner jacket, of course. And there I was, a civilian in a dinner jacket in one of His Majesty's ships on a Sunday morning. And I broke surface like a great seal coming up through the ice. And in the middle of prayers, they were all up there singing and everything. I was pushed down again by a petty officer. And
how far out to sea were you?
Out of sight of land.
Well, which is and far enough.
Porpoises whizzing around us all the time. And somebody said, well, you must go down to the wardroom now. The officers want to see you. And I thought, well, I thought I was going to be told to walk the plank or something. And I went down there. Nobody said anything about why I was on board, why I had a dinner jacket or anything. And then they gave me something little sort of rectifying fluid of some sort, made me feel better. And then they said the admiral, a man called Admiral Drax, wants to see you. I thought, well, this is it. This is shot at dawn. This is at the end. So I went down to the admiral's cabin, and he said, do you have lunch? And I said, thank you, sir. He never mentioned my dinner jacket or why I was there. And I thought, this is... something happened last night. I drank the wrong thing or something. So anyway, I sat down to lunch, and a sailor came in, and he said, HMS Bounty off the starboard bow, sir. And I thought I was going to die. I just read this mutiny on the Bounty book. So the admiral said, oh, Niven, look out of the starboard scupper and see if you can see her. I poked my head out of this window thing, and there she was. Guns going off, people in pigtails, and Clark Gable on it, and a few other people. I didn't know too late. And then, of course, it was a put-up show. They knew they were going to meet it. It was a publicity thing that Metro had arranged. It was the old British battleship meeting the modern British battleship, and the admiral said, this is where you get off, Niven, and I was lowered over the side on the end of a rope in my dinner jacket. I arrived in Hollywood on the Bounty.
Well, you came in on a hit picture anyway. David, I know that you're British, but how did you happen to start your acting career in Hollywood instead of over in England?
Pure financial necessity.
You mean you were rich in England and poor here?
Well, I was in the army in England. I went to Sandhurst, which is the same as your West Point, and I was a regular soldier. And then in those days, you could resign your commission if it was dull. And it was very dull in peacetime, and I resigned mine and went to Canada. And then I came out here, as I said, by these series of strange mistakes.
Yes, and now you're in a hit picture before you start in pictures. Now, how did you really get started in pictures then?
Well, I then arrived with Frank Lloyd. He was out on this boat on the Bounty.
He was directing the picture.
Yeah, and this was a press warm-up thing. And in fact, Bill Mooring was there at the time. He witnessed this horrible arrival of mine. And Frank Lloyd and Bob Montgomery were there for some reason, I don't know. And they said, where do you want to go? And I said, well, back to Santa Barbara's where the rest of my props are, my clothes and everything. So they said, we'll take you up as far as Metro and you can get a bus. So I drove up to Metro and I swept in through the gates of this enormous studio in my dinner jacket. It was now 5 o'clock in the evening. Onto the foot of Eddie Goulding, I got out of the car. And he was told this story by Frank Lloyd. And he said, well, I want somebody to play the drunken younger brother to Ruth Chatterton in a picture he was just going to do. He said, will you make a test? So I said, if you'll lend me a suit and put me up for the night, I'd love to. So Goulding didn't lend me a suit. He put me up for the night. And in the morning, I was there in my dinner jacket, 9 o'clock. And
this tired dinner jacket.
All gray around the collar.
Whatever happened to this dinner jacket incident?
I think I still got it.
I can only say this proves why British men are supposed to be the best dressed in the world.
Lloyd Sloan.
Well, I only
Excuse me, Sidney.
I was going to say something.
Go ahead, Sidney.
I was going to say that this only proves to all those aspiring actors listening in how you break into the movies.
It isn't quite as easy as that, because I did this test, which is absolutely dreadful, but Mae West saw it and wanted me in a picture of hers, and I got myself an agent, and I borrowed $200 from him, and I went and got my clothes from Santa Barbara, and I got myself a place to live, and I was just about to sign. And the day before, there was the tramp of heavy feet, and the immigration people caught up and gave me 24 hours to get out of the country.
Again?
They had seen the test.
No. No, I was on a 14-day visitor's pass, you see, and of course I had no right whatever to take a job, which I was just about to do, which I must say I didn't mean to do. I mean, I didn't do anything really naughty. So I was put on a train. I went to Mexico.
That's right. You washed dishes in a certain kind of house down there, didn't you?
Yes, in a place called the Owl. Sort of bar place.
Uh-huh. Where was that, Mexicali?
Mexicali. Uh-huh. And then I came back in with a quota number and it allowed me to work. And by that time, the picture had been finished with Mae West. Goulding had gone away. Frank Lloyd had disappeared into the hills. And I became an extra quickly, and I was English type number 4008.
David, had you thought of acting in England, or was it just an idea that hit you when the financial necessity arose here?
It was, yes. I'd done sort of amateur theatricals, as we all have done, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Not all. I haven't.
You haven't, did you?
No.
You must
start. You're the one.
Hank Weaver has.
Well, you've been back making pictures in England since you came to Hollywood, I know.
I have.
Well, what are the major differences between Hollywood and England now? Do you think you can account for any?
Well, I've always been there, loaned out by my boss, Sam Goldwyn, you see, and sent over there on an ordinary loan-out deal, so I never came up against any of the financial difficulties.
Mm-hmm. Oh, Mr. Niven, may I interrupt? I'm sure this is all mad and wonderful, and I'm not being facetious, really, but I would like to get personal, if you don't mind. I'd like to know how you met your wife, who is supposed to be the most beautiful woman in the world, incidentally, as if you didn't know.
I quite agree about that. Well, anyway, I was doing a picture for Corder called Bonnie Prince Charlie, which hasn't come over here yet. And I'd been dismissed for the day, and I had a horrible blonde wig on and a kilt and a few other things, and I was delighted to be leaving. I got to the gate, I'd taken all these horrible things off, and the gate man said, "You're wanted back on the set." So I went back on the set, furious. It's now 5:40 or something, tired. "Where's my chair?" I said. I did the full movie star routine. And they said, "Oh, there's somebody sitting in it." And I looked up, and there was this beautiful girl we were married 10 days later.
Oh.
I gave her hell, though, for being in the chair for a while.
Dar Smith.
Well, David, you were under contract to Mr. Goldwyn for these 14 years. Would you really go back to work for him, like you just said you would, even if he gave you good money?
I think the money, no object, of course. But I think that Sam Goldwyn is without question the greatest producer in Hollywood. And if he asked me to work in another picture of his, I can't wait to go back. The only reason I wanted to get away was because he didn't use me in his pictures and he lent me to other people.
David, the whole world by now knows that Sam Goldwyn's famous for his somewhat distorted phrases, better known as Goldwynisms, like the famous "Include Me Out" or "It's a Lovely Day to Spend Sunday." Can you think of some that he said to you personally that haven't been used? There must be.
The only one that was ever said to me personally was when I went off to the war in 39, and I wrote Sam a note thanking him for all he'd done, hoping for a bonus, which I didn't get. And he was very pleased with this thing, and he very sentimental about it, and he asked me to come and see him to say goodbye, and I went in there. And Jock Lawrence, his publicity man, was sitting there. And Mr. Goldwyn said, "David, this is the most private, wonderful letter that's ever come to me. This is so private. Jock, I want this letter to leak out to the press." The only one that ever happened to me.
That's a lovely one. Mr. Niven, you sort of skipped casually over this moment ago. I would like to know whatever happened to Bonnie Prince Charlie. Weren't you making it for 2 years, 2 years ago?
Well, the picture was, I think, from the moment they first started to photograph anything to do with it until the time it was finished, it took 2 years. I was actually over there 5 months.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been released in England and just been released in Canada. And it's coming here in about 2 months, I think.
Frankly, I'm anxious to see you in kilts.
Well, I've worn them all my life. I was born in the Western Highlands of Scotland.
Sidney?
Well, David, here's a minor grievance I'd like to take up with you. A motion picture star usually gets a chance to read a script and give his approval before accepting the role in the film. In fact, as your countryman William Shakespeare said, the play's the thing. If that's so, then why do you actors in interviews give more credit to directors than writers? I mean, you're always saying the director did this, the director did that, and you never mention the writer.
It could be that the directors give the jobs.
Well, I thought the producers give the jobs.
Well, they all help each other a lot.
Yeah, they help it, but the writer helps it, and he never gets the break.
Let me say this in self-defense about myself, that only last Sunday...
You played Walt Shakespeare.
I played Shakespeare at the Screenwriters Guild.
Did a wonderful job, too.
Party.
Oh, that was beautiful.
And I was Shakespeare trying to sell Hamlet to a producer. I'm all for the writers.
Well, good. I'm glad to hear that. Not that I'm a writer, you know, but...
But I think the era was of the big of the big directors, then of the big stars, and I really firmly believe it's now going to be the big writers. It should be.
It should be. That's what I feel.
David, there's something that I've wondered about for a long time. You've been in America all these years. How is it you've never become a citizen?
Well, that's a very leading question. That's a question that I always seem to get asked whenever I'm going from England to America or from America to England. And I have lived here in your country for 15 years, except for 6 years I spent in the British Army during the war. And I think I just have to tell you the truth. I am the man who likes to have his cake and eat it. I'm profoundly proud of being British, and I love living in America and working here, and I love my friends here. So until they tell me I can't have it both ways, I'm going to go on having it.
What about the taxes in this situation?
Well, I pay my tax here where I work.
And you have nothing in England, then?
No
problems?
No. I have problems.
Well,
but
I guess the government really doesn't care. Our government, that is.
Get off taxes for a minute, David. You're very rarely seen in public. I assume that you confine your social life to private parties. Is there a good reason for this?
Well, I like it much more, honestly. I hate noise. And I think you can choose the people you rub your elbows against in private parties, and you get out of these other places, you never know what's going to happen. I'm a terribly bad dancer. And I get very hot in those places, too.
Didn't they teach you how to dance at Sandhurst?
Oh, yes. Sword dances and things like that. You can get me anywhere on the strip.
Lloyd Sloan, back to you again.
We should have told you. No,
I never answered your question about the difference between working in England and studio in America.
Why doesn't somebody pick that up?
Go ahead.
Well, actually, David, I never got an answer to what the differences are between working in England and here.
You mean beside money, the working conditions?
Oh, yeah.
Well, I didn't mean to brush it off or through, but I think the first thing is that it's a much more highly paid job as far as electricians, carpenters, and that echelon of studio workers goes. Is much more highly paid in this country, in America. And I think that a much more intelligent class of man goes into it here. And the labor troubles are enormous in England. It never seemed to get solved. And the time taken on pictures is out of all proportion. And therefore the expense is that much greater.
Well, that speaks well for Hollywood, David. I'm glad to hear a good word for it for a change.
You sound bitter, Mr. Skolsky.
Me? Never bitter. David, when I left you on the last question way back there, you were walking out of Goldwyn's office and going to war. And I know you had a remarkable service record. I mean, a sort of cloak and dagger stuff. A movie hero without the camera going. Would you mind yakking a little bit about it? Don't be modest.
Well, I've nothing to yak about, honestly. I think if you volunteer and you're there, it doesn't matter whether you're lucky enough to do anything, you can't do more. And I think miserable people I met were the people who volunteered and found themselves pulling out teeth 500 miles behind the lines or something.
Mm-hmm.
And what did I you do? You didn't pull any teeth, did you?
No, I saw a lot of it, of course, from Dunkirk on. But I have one sort of phobia about talking about the thing, because can I tell a tiny story?
Certainly.
I wasn't in the Ardennes battle, because the British Army wasn't involved in it, thank goodness. And I went down there. I had a letter from a friend of mine in New York. And she said, if ever you go near, and she mentioned this place in the Ardennes, will you try and find Charlie's grave? This is the son's grave, because he was killed there. And I had some leave, and I went down, and I looked for it. And in this valley, she said. And what I found, of course, is 24,000 graves. And I thought, there's 24,000, very good reason why I should always keep my trap shut about the little tiny bit I contributed to it.
It's a very wonderful nice story.
Mikhail?
May we have a little more levity? You have a great reputation as a practical joker. Not the ordinary run-of-the-mill kind, but I just wondered what gag gave you the biggest boot, personally.
I think... Oh, it sounds awful to tell him over, doesn't it?
Sometimes. It's a
not
calling.
Not when you tell them.
Years ago, we were making The Prisoner of Zenda, and I had a very small part in it, and I very nearly never worked again after it, too. And we had 300 or 400 extras dressed as dukes and duchesses, all in resplendent clothes. In those days, Sidney, this is right, isn't it? You got $3 if you didn't speak, and you got $11 if you did, I
yes,
think.
That's so right, if you had a few lines.
Yes, if anybody came on the set and said, good morning, the whole set said, how are you? And they
that's
all got $11.
Right.
It was a terrible shambles. And I saw all these people, and I noticed something that day about extras, which depressed me ever since, and that is that they are always in complete agreement, one with the other. If they're not allowed to speak, they're always nodding, and they never... snarling at each other. So anyway, they were circulating around this big bowl of punch. So during the luncheon interval, I put 11 bottles of Raymond Massey's gin into the punch bowl. And everybody got $11 about 4 days.
Can you think of another one?
Oh. Give me time.
Oh. Just let somebody else ask. I think we can throw another one.
Oh, that was so good, though.
Sure. Yeah, that was very cute. Yes, we're quite short here.
That's the reason I looked at the clock.
It's all been going very...
I still want to get in about your friend...
Trubshaw.
We're 20 even, aren't we?
What is that?
Well, how about cirrhosis by the sea? Nobody's asking.
Oh, there's some wonderful stories connected with this very good friend of Mr. Niven's. His name was Trubshaw, or is Trubshaw.
Yes.
All right, let me
bring his name
to
it
and say,
Oh, good. Well, we can keep that with him.
I just drop. He takes me out completely.
Yeah, well, I can sort of say something about Hitchcock is in a scene and so forth. You bring in a friend.
Lead into it.
From the practical joke, you could say, and you could say, and in some of those practical jokes, wasn't there your...
I have thought of another thing to do with the war,
joke?
Which is nothing to do with me as any kind of a man who did anything good, which is really quite interesting.
Yes.
Let's roll.
All right, you want to go back and do it?
How do you want to
keep
it
going? How are we going to get into this now?
You could say, but something like that, if it's something that doesn't affect you as being a great big frightened colonel. Is there anything else?
Somebody might say, well, is it very light? Is it light, or...
It's very interesting. I tell you exactly what it was.
That's it.
It's
yes,
I think
it's better. Then you'd have a hard time
that's
following
right.
It, David.
Yeah,
to even follow or to proceed it, because
yeah.
I remember you let in it.
Very nicely. It was good for you, you know, what you said.
Yeah,
it was good.
On this Trubshaw guy, I could say something about Hitchcock has his little trademark, you know, where he's always in a scene. Mr. Niven always gets the name of Trubshaw into it.
All right, take off.
You just pick up any way you want after the yuck.
What has he said?
Listen, one thing, the thing about the citizenship, did that make any sense?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, very good.
Very honest and very understandable.
Yeah, and understandable.
You
yeah,
could throw
something
in there. Do you think you ever will?
No, I think you do.
No, there's no pretense to it. There's no.
I think when you try to do, I think you try to. No, well, she's got one. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm trying to think how.
I don't think we can improve on it.
We've got 20 minutes, haven't we?
Yeah. So good. So good.
Nikki, let you go ahead with.
I'm trying to think how to start it.
Well, you did.
Hitchcock thing.
Oh,
what you said.
Oh, all right. Should I just?
Yeah. Just take off.
Well, just say that. Well, undoubtedly there are more, but there's one thing I want to ask you first. Put it that way. Undoubtedly there are some more gags.
Practical joke gags.
But there's one thing I want to be sure we get in here.
Undoubtedly there are a lot more gags that you could tell us, Mr. Niven. But there's one thing I'd like to bring out. For instance, director Alfred Hitchcock has sort of a little trademark. He appears in one scene in every one of his pictures. And don't you bring in the name of a very dear friend of yours in every picture, Trubshaw?
Well, that's very foxy of you to know that, but yes, I do. Travshaw is a man who was in the regular British Army years ago with me, and he's 6'6", and he has a moustache so big you can see it from the back on a clear day. And he's splendid. And Travshaw was always in trouble, for instance, we were stationed in Dover Castle, which is a great Gothic pile on the south coast of England at one time. Travshaw and I were confined to barracks by the colonel. We were both second lieutenants. We were confined to barracks for some small misdemeanor, than what it was.
Mm-hmm.
And we were sitting there, rather miserable in this castle all alone, and in came a general called Sir Hereward Wake, frightening-looking old gentleman, great bristling moustache. And he said, "Show me round." Well, we'd only been in the place about 3 days. We'd just come back from Malta. We didn't know where anything was very much, so Travshaw suddenly developed into a terrible sort of head waiter. He said, "Oh, follow me." So, terrible thing. We went off. We didn't know where anything was. We were making it all up. And finally, he got a little bit suspicious. He was followed by this staff. He said, "What's that building there, Travshaw?" So Travshaw looked at it, and there, in letters of fire written on the door, was "Firehouse." So Travshaw said, "Well, good Lord, the firehouse written on the door. Get it out." He said, "Get the engine out." "What sort of an engine is it?" So Travshaw said, "Oh, it's a great big red thing. It's got piles of hose all over it." "What? Get it out," he said. So Travshaw said, "Yes, sir. Mr. Nevin, get the engine out." So I nearly dropped dead, and I said, "Yes, sir. Sergeant Major, the engine, get it out, will you, please?" So the Sergeant Major went green, and he said, "Very good, sir. Corporal McFarlane, get the engine out. Ask Corporal McGuire, get the engine." Everybody was giving. Nobody had a key. Nobody had the faintest idea how to get it out. And the general was going blue, great veins standing out all over him. He said, "Get it out." And Trapshaw went on elaborating while we were waiting for something to happen. And he said, "Oh, we put out a big fire the other day, sir, down in the village. A lot of people were saved." And, "Get it out," said the general. So finally, the ignominious thing of my career, a little man arrived with a screwdriver from the armourer's department, and he unscrewed the lock, and Travshaw pushed the thing, and he opened it with tremendous flourish. He said, "The fire engine, sir. 2 women's bicycles." Never had been a fire engine, ever.
Travshaw.
I can see how you fell in love with Travshaw.
Travshaw, hopeless.
I love his moustaches.
Why is he in every picture, though?
Well, it just became a sort of trademark. I thought it brought me good luck. It's brought me some good luck and some terribly bad luck, but I always bash his name in there.
He's your personal Harvey.
Well, have you heard from him lately? Does he know he's in the picture?
Oh, yes. He always says, "Wait, I'll sue you when I need the money," he says.
Certainly. Just had his option picked up.
Well, so much for our Hollywood press conference. We'll be back in a minute and grant Mr. Niven the opportunity to quiz our 4 Hollywood reporters. But first, let's listen to Mel Hunt.
Here's a warning to you listeners. Some of you are heading for a fall unless you're careful. Did you know that half of all fatalities in this country are caused by falls? See if these danger points apply to your home. Do you have handrails for all stairways? All ladders and porch stairs in good repair? Are small rugs tacked down or skid-proofed? Are halls and stairs well-lighted and free of tripping hazards? You can easily tell from this checklist what certain types of dangers are. Whenever there's a question of safety, remember, always play it safe. Don't take chances with America's number one accident killer, home accidents. And now back to our moderator, Hank Weaver.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to your reserved seat at our coast-to-coast Hollywood press table with our guest star, David Niven. Mr. Niven has just been interviewed by Dar Smith of the Los Angeles Daily News, Mikhail Novak of the Philadelphia Bulletin, Sidney Skolsky, syndicated columnist for the New York Post, and Lloyd Sloan, Hollywood Citizen News and Movie Life magazine. Now it's time to shift our press conference into reverse and entertain a few questions from the very entertaining Mr. David Niven. Hold it.
I keep thinking of Trapshaw.
He has millions of Trapshaw.
Is that his real name, Trapshaw?
Oh, yes.
This is the first name, and I think now this is where you...
All right.
Where you asked the...
I'll read this.
He broke him up.
Why don't you say that? No,
leave that here.
How much longer have we got? I keep thinking of Travshaw. Really?
Yeah.
Let him add that.
Yeah,
that was all right.
Let him
laugh.
I keep thinking of
Travshaw.
Maybe I said it. No, because we said cut first. You said cut.
He said cut first. No.
We'll come on the same level.
No. Unless you do, you can give me a straight lead.
Okay.
Well, listen, I don't have to. We can ask a gay one. What do you think?
Go ahead, do it, Hank.
Bill, why don't you get a wild track on I was thinking of Travshaw.
Well,
Well, about how are we on time?
Well, you have questions for us.
Well, I think it's worthwhile.
Oh.
Now, this is where our palms get sweaty.
Oh, brother.
I've only got one, anyway.
No, that certain kind of house is just bad.
The story, the war story, I wouldn't tell you, said him. Do it now, but
you meant
I was going to tell you, then I was sent for by MI5, which are our spy people in the British Army, and asked if I could impersonate General Montgomery. And I said, well, apart from the fact that he's 5'3" and I'm 6', it's the easiest thing in the world, but it was an extraordinary story. I had to find a man and train him to impersonate Monty, yes.
Oh, the double?
I did the whole thing for that.
No kidding.
And the man goes around on the music hall giving me screen credit, saying that I trained him.
Really?
Yeah.
No.
Hank, give me a straighter lead.
I'll open the whole thing.
If I can,
well, let him say the other thing anyway.
Unfortunately,
let him just try it and say I keep thinking of this, and let him do it the other way.
No,
anyway,
I'll do the whole thing straight. We all set?
No, I mean, let him just do that, and if it comes out.
Now you understand? He's going to throw it to you, Mr. Nitton.
Yeah.
And then you're going to come back and ask him what. Now, have you thought of anything else?
No, I just thought that one, and then the one you suggested I put in, if you like. I've got one anyway, and I'd like to hear the answer anyway.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to your reserved seat at our coast-to-coast Hollywood press table with our guest star, David Niven. Mr. Niven has just been interviewed by Dar Smith of the Los Angeles Daily News, Mikhail Novak of the Philadelphia Bulletin, Sidney Skolsky, syndicated columnist for the New York Post, and Lloyd Sloan, Hollywood Citizen News and Movie Life magazine. Well, now it's time to shift our press conference into reverse and entertain a few questions from the very entertaining David Niven.
Well, I have one question I would love to get the answer to. It's this. Is there... Now, bearing in mind that a news story, and a good news story, must be the most important thing to a newspaper man, or the finding of one, and the dispensing of it, bearing that in mind, isn't there anything that can be done by the finest of the the newspaper people here to counteract what seems to me to be a sort of campaign to denigrate Hollywood and to knock it, to mock it, and in fact ruin something that many of us have worked very, very hard for a long time to make good? Is it necessary that if something like, all right, an illegitimate baby, just because it happens to happen in the movie colony, does it have to be a worldwide shambles? Can't it be somehow, not hushed up, I suppose, but does it have to be played on and bashed on?
As long as people are in the limelight, it has to be played up.
Well, it doesn't necessarily have to be played up. It just automatically plays itself up.
I want to go into that a little bit. It doesn't automatically play itself up. Somebody's got to start it. Somebody's got to put it into the papers.
Well, but if the demand weren't there, David, they wouldn't go into the papers. In other words, if the readers didn't want that stuff, there wouldn't be any point in printing it. Obviously, they do eat it up.
We have people in the newspaper business who very carefully check circulation figures each day and compare them to what story was played up most that day. And the story that was played up best and sold the most papers is the most readable story, and thereby becomes the story that sells the most papers, therefore is the most popular story.
Well, now, I speak with a tiny modicum of experience as a newspaper man, because just after the war, Lord Beaverbrook, who owns, you know, the London Daily Express, cabled me and asked me if I would write a column on Hollywood, and I was very flattered that anybody should ever ask me to write anything. So I proceeded to do it, and I wrote two, and I cannot think why, but they went down very well indeed. Then I suddenly realized, of course, in my case, it was hopeless, because I was going out to dinner with my friends and going back home and writing about them. and pretty soon I was running out of friends, and so I stopped it quick. And Beaverbrook was very nice about it. He let me off. But in the meantime, I was made a member of the foreign press here. And pretty soon I got the press handouts from the studios about their people, including, believe it or not, my own about myself for my studio, which came through the mail.
And it was pretty dull.
I've never read such nonsense in my life.
Maybe this is part of your answer.
Well, now, is it part of the answer? Because
it's part of it, and yet it's not the whole answer. I mean, a newspaper, putting out a newspaper is like putting out a number of pictures at a studio. And they've got to put out various types of pictures and they put out various type stories in a paper, and it's the type of picture that sells that they keep making or that you want to make, and it's the type story that sells papers that they play up or that they think sells papers, and they check pretty well. Now, getting back to the illegitimate baby, as you termed it, or the Bergman baby, as a matter of fact, that didn't happen in Hollywood. It happened in Italy, and Hollywood shouldn't be censored for that. And isn't, I don't think. And I don't, and of course, as a matter of opinion, I'm Bergman on that thing. But the story is being played. It might be being played too much, but it is news, and there is a certain amount of interest in it.
Good night. May I lean on this a little bit? Am I
yes,
able?
No, go ahead.
Also, I seem to pick up my paper every day, or my papers every day,
yeah.
And every single day there is featured a divorce in Hollywood. And 9 times out of 10, there are people I've never heard of, and I've been in the industry for 15 years. But it always is that Hollywood thrown in with a divorce.
That's right. And that's done. I agree. I think that's done a little too much, and it goes back to the old days that I know, that any girl that ever worked in a Ziegfeld show, if she got drunk or was in an auto accident or in a scandal, it was Ziegfeld beauty in this.
Yes.
And now anyone who's ever had a license to drive a car in Hollywood and played an extra in a picture as a Hollywood movie actress. And that part is a little unfair, and when you get to the story, I think people of some taste and that have some brains realize that, and I think all that stuff finds its level after a while.
Well, in my paper, which happens to be the Los Angeles Daily News, we have to prove, if we say a Hollywood star got in a jam of some sort, we have to be able to prove that this person has actually starred in a picture.
Well, who has to prove it down the paper, Doc?
The rewrite man who handled the story.
Well, will he know?
Well, he can check his record books, just like the sports record books.
Anyway,
we've all
may I extract a tiny promise?
Mr. Niven, get back in, please.
No, can I just say one thing?
Yeah.
I think I read somewhere that the New York Times put the original Bergman story on page 7 or 8 inside, and a lot of papers didn't play it down that much, but on lesser stories, say, that don't merit that much importance, I think a lot of papers today are handling them a little more carefully than they have in the past. And I think Dar's point about the news, and I think our paper, the Citizen News, does watch them rather carefully. There are a lot of papers that go in for sensationalism, and they are the ones that probably always will do something like this. And even our agreeing that it's wrong isn't going to change
it. I think it gets down to a matter of taste and judgment on who's the editor of the paper, the same as who's a producer of a picture. And,
sure.
And you can make the same story.
Well, may I extract one promise from you, because you're obviously influential, highly thought of members of the society
Dear
I'm talking
boy.
About.
Thank you so much.
Please, every time you feel behoven to write something that is bearing down a little hardly on Hollywood, that you will turn over the sheet and write something that doesn't bear down hardly but bears down well on the same subject on the other side.
David, you know me, but don't get me wrong, I love Hollywood.
Well, having extracted your promise, Mr. Niven, I see our time is just about up. And it's time to call a halt and call 30 to another edition of Hollywood Byline. But before saying goodnight, our sincere thanks to you, David Niven, for appearing on this program. Mr. Niven, by the way, will soon be seen in the Powell Pressburger production, The Elusive Pimpernel. And of course, our thanks, too, to our panel of reporters, Sidney Skolsky of the New York Post Syndicate, Mikhail Novak of the Philadelphia Bulletin, Dar Smith of the Los Angeles Daily News, and Lloyd Sloan of the Hollywood Citizen News and Movie Life magazine. See you all at our Hollywood press table at the same time next week. Until then, this is Hank Weaver saying good night from Hollywood.
Listen in again at the same time next week when ABC, over many of these stations, presents another edition of Hollywood Byline, featuring an exclusive on-the-air press conference with an outstanding movie star interviewed by reporters whose beat is Hollywood, the film and glamour capital of the world. Next week, our guest will be Kirk Douglas. Hollywood Byline is directed by William T. Johnson and is transcribed in Hollywood. Now, here's a listening reminder.